From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents, context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Pittsburgh, California.
Oh, I'm not from the Bay Area.
Pinole, California.
Pinole, California.
San Jose.
I'm from Paradise, California, up north.
San Jose, South San Jose.
Coming up, we visit the skeletons of UC Berkeley.
It's about respect, and it's about power. It's about the ability to look out for and control for the well-being of our own ancestors and not have outsiders tell us what's good for us.
Also, we'll unearth what lies beneath Emeryville's Bay Street shopping mall.
Victoria's Secret, in the back part of the store towards the parking lot, at least 100 bodies were removed from that very specific site alone.
And we'll meet the man known as the last wild Indian in California.
Not a single word of English does he know. Where he came from is a mystery.
We've got more than meets the eye today on Cross Currents. For years, there's been a rumor that dinosaur bones were cemented inside of UC Berkeley's iconic Campanile clock tower. It's not true. But the university is storing bones. Tens of thousands of them are under the Hearst swimming pool, and they're human, including members of numerous Native American tribes. The university has unearthed and studied these remains for centuries. They've taught researchers a great deal about California's prehistoric past, but living members of some of those tribes say the knowledge comes at too high a cost. KALW's Joaquin Palomino has the story.
UC Berkeley is home to the country's second largest collection of human skeletons outside of a graveyard, about 12,000 total. Tim White is a professor of integrative biology.
Well, it turns out that the human skeleton, indeed the skeleton of any mammal, is a very good guide to that animal's life.
And when animals, or people in this case, are thousands of years old, scientists need a lot of help to figure out what those lives were like.
So it's a holistic study, just like a crime scene investigation, except these are very cold cases with very ancient evidence.
Studying the bones of Native Californians has taught scientists a great deal about how people first came to the Golden State. We know what they ate, where they lived, and how they responded to different changes in the climate. We even know something about how they got sick.
One is on the incidence of tuberculosis, which many people for many years thought was an induced disease, in other words, imported from Europe. It turns out that tuberculosis strains were here in the New World long before contact with Europeans.
White says the bones are crucial to scientific pursuits, but to people like Clay DeMont, that argument doesn't hold up.
Science is typically seen, right, again, as something which is pan-human, as something which is important for everyone everywhere. And I don't think that's the case.
DeMont is a professor of sociology at San Francisco State University and an expert in Native American repatriation law. He says many tribes value their skeletons in a different way.
Native peoples tend to believe that we know our own history and that we don't need the archaeologists or the physical anthropologists to use their ways of knowing to validate our ways of knowing.
DeMont is in a unique position in this debate. He's a social scientist and also a member of Southern Oregon's Klamath tribe. He says the study of Native American skeletons is rooted in a long, dirty history.
Really, from the moment that Europeans set foot on the east coast of North America, they began to disturb native graves.
He talks about diaries from the Mayflower describing the desecration of native graves, of founding fathers exhuming skeletons on their properties, and of dead warriors being decapitated on the battlefield, all in the name of science.
Native dead were treated differently than everyone else's dead. So, for example, if there was a road going in and there were white folks uncovered, dead white folks, they would go to the coroner and they would go for reburial. But Native people would go to a lab or to a museum or to a university.
In the mid-19th century, scientists studied Native American skulls to try and show that they were inferior to Caucasians. Some also thought Native Americans were a dying race.
They believed that it was important to hold on to these remains and to study them and to try to figure out how Native people fit into this cultural or into this human evolution story that they were telling.
DeMont says the underlying issues have not gone away.
It's about respect and it's about power. It's about the ability to look out for and control for the well-being of our own ancestors and not have outsiders tell us what's good for us.
In 1990, the government passed the Native American Grave and Repatriation Act, or NAGPRA. The law mandates that Native American tribes have first right to skeletal remains and artifacts, as long as there's proof of cultural lineage.
What's happened is basically a shift in the balance of power.
Again, UC Berkeley's Tim White.
These disenfranchised people now have a chance to come in and ask questions about what are the holdings in this museum and how do those holdings relate to us.
The law has made 45,000 human remains and over 1 million artifacts available for repatriation. Most returned remains are put back in the earth, but a few tribes don't even want them back. They've agreed that the university is putting them to better use.
They have control of the materials, but they've chosen to leave them in the Hearst Museum because they understand the facilities are better. It doesn't preclude them downstream moving those materials into a tribal museum or whatever.
Still, about three-quarters of UC Berkeley's collection is kept without tribal permission. About 100 tribes in California are federally recognized. 40 aren't. Those tribes don't receive benefits from the Bureau of Indian Affairs, and they're not protected by NAGPRA. A 2010 amendment changed this. So now, even without federal recognition, tribes can recover bones taken from indigenous lands. At UC Berkeley, this means 6,000 of the roughly 10,000 culturally unaffiliated remains could be returned, which has scientists like White worried.
It's the largest collection on Earth of people who lived in a hunting and gathering economy. That would be lost, and it wouldn't be lost for next year's researchers alone. It would be lost for researchers 100 years from now who came in with new techniques to learn more things.
UC Berkeley's Hearst Museum has hired 4 additional staff to help catalog the collection and figure out what bones go where. The university is also helping several tribes set up their own museums. In Berkeley, I'm Joaquin Palomino for Cross Currents.
Do you think universities should store Native remains for study? Share your thoughts at 415-264-7106. Again, that's 415-264-7106. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Ben Trefney. UC Berkeley is just one of the places in the Bay Area where bones can be found underground. Another lies just off Shell Mound Street in Emeryville. In this piece from our archives, I speak with filmmaker Andres Sediel at Bay Street Emeryville to talk about his documentary Shell Mound and find out what lies beneath the surface of this shopping mall.
First off, as we sit here right now, what are we looking at?
Well, there's the huge AMC movie theater complex in front of us, but you know that you have Starbucks, Barnes & Noble, Banana Republic, Old Navy, you name it, it's here.
Your documentary, you look beyond this into the history of the site. What used to be here? What was here basically before they built this shopping plaza?
Well, you know, right before the mall went in, there was a pigment factory here where they made pigments for paint, and it was a highly toxic industry where, you know, operating with very few regulations that, you know, just dump tons of toxins into the soil. And this is, you know, being on the edge of the bay, it's a lot of bay mud. So those toxics have been seeping in for years and decades. But before the pigment plant, there was a pesticide plant. There was a lime and sulfur plant. There's been a ton of industry, not only all over Emeryville, but at this very specific spot.
So right underneath where we're sitting, this is all paved over for Bay Street for all these stores. So right where we're sitting underneath us, this used to be basically a toxic wasteland?
Toxic wasteland is a pretty good way to describe it. When folks came in here to work, they found over 50 different chemicals on this very site. And we're talking about lead and arsenic and volatile organic compounds and all kinds of nasty stuff that was all mixed up together. So all, you know, a lot of times you know how to deal with lead or you know how to deal with arsenic. What do you do when they're mixed up together? A lot of the workers had to wear essentially space suits and little, they called them crickets, that would hang around their neck and they would beep if hydrogen sulfide was in the area, because once you come in contact with that, you have to leave the area immediately. It can be fatal.
And so they started to try to clean it up in the 90s, is that right?
They had been working, the city of Emeryville had had their eyes on this site for a long time for redevelopment because of its location. And it was actually very hard for them to attract other retailers to the area to start a business so close to this toxic wasteland. So it took about 15 years of planning and development before the city of Emeryville was able to take over this piece of property and begin the very expensive cleanup.
I see. So these construction workers start to clean up this site. They're wearing their spacesuits. They have their crickets to make sure they don't die. And what do they find under there? What did you find when you were making your documentary? What did they discover?
Well, they uncovered a piece of history that was the fact that this site on Shell Mound Street was the site of one of the largest Native American burial grounds in all of California, the Emeryville Shell Mound. It was very well known to archaeologists. It was a site that had been excavated in the early 20th century. The bulk of the shell mound, which was a huge mound, you know, to give you an idea, most people think it's a mound, it's the shells, how big could it be? Estimates were that it stood 60 feet high and was approximately the area of two football fields. So we're talking about a huge mass of earth made out of shells and bones. It was a virtual repository of everything that the native people here ate and how they lived. They found an entire whale skeleton here in the early 20s buried in there. And when it was finally bulldozed in 1924 to make way for this industry, 651 human burials were uncovered. So once they started breaking ground to build this mall, they were actually digging into the burial ground itself. And as it turns out, the area below ground was where the highest concentrations of burials were.
Who were the people who were buried here? Who were the people who lived here back before any of this redevelopment happened?
The native people of the San Francisco Bay Area are called today Ohlone people, which is basically a language group that stretched from the North Bay all the way down to Santa Cruz. We know that the Bay Area most likely was populated continuously for approximately 10,000 years since the last ice age, but the Ohlone people would have been inhabiting this specific spot in Emeryville for at least the last 3,000 years.
What kind of significance did the shell mounds have for them?
Well, they obviously had a lot of significance, or else they wouldn't have built so many of them. There were over 400 in the San Francisco Bay, and also the size indicates that it was something of importance. Emeryville was by far the largest. It was a huge site, but the top portion of it, you can imagine it was in the shape of a cone, was leveled in the late 1800s to make way for a dance pavilion. This whole area became known as Shell Mound Park. It was an amusement park. There was rides here. There was carousels. There was a horse racetrack. There was a beer garden. It was the place to go on the weekend for San Franciscans trying to get out of the city.
And that was followed by toxic industrial chemical sites, and then Bay Street, an outdoor shopping mall in Emeryville, where Andre Sediel and I were talking. Andre Sediel is a documentary filmmaker. His movie Shell Mound tells the story of that site, just north of where the Bay Bridge touches the East Bay. You can hear an extended version of our conversation at kalw.org. Do you know of other places in the Bay Area that aren't only what they appear to be? Let us know on our Facebook page. We're KALW News. This is Cross Currents. I'm Ben Trefney. Many of the bones we've discussed today are hidden from view, underground, in basements, in libraries. But the Bay Area is also home to some very public remains. Last year marked the 100th anniversary of the public debut of a man called Ishii. Ishii was Native American, a Yana from the Deer Creek area, about 150 miles northeast of Berkeley. For the past century, he's been known as the last wild Indian in North America. In some ways, he's famous. The Anthropology Department building at UC Berkeley is named for Alfred Kroeber, the scholar who worked closely with Ishii. UC Berkeley's anthropology community held a conference last September dedicated to Ishii's memory, and the California Museum in Sacramento features some of his possessions in an extensive exhibit. So who was Ishii? And how could Ishii have been the so-called last Indian when close to a million Native Americans live in California today? Reporter Taria Smith, who's also California Native American, tells us Ishii's story.
Imagine spending 3 years alone in the woods of California. You've lost your entire family and all of your close friends to war, disease, and starvation. Every day, you fish and hunt to feed yourself and try to avoid being spotted by other people. Then, one day, you wander into a place that's slightly foreign, a town, and everything changes. This is the story of Ishii, perhaps one of the most famous California Native Americans. He was first found 100 years ago on August 28, 1911, near an Oroville slaughterhouse. The sheriff took Ishii to the jail, saying it was for his own safety. Ishii was barefoot, wearing hide and canvas clothes. It wasn't long before curious looky-loos started coming to see the wild man. Many years later, this episode was dramatized in a TV movie called Ishii, The Last of His Civilization.
What in the Sam hell do you got there?
It's an Indian, Pete. Just an Indian.
There was no TV at the time, but the newspaper created a sensation. One headline from the San Francisco Call read, Ishii, the last Aboriginal savage in America.
Which he wasn't, of course. The story was really largely fabricated.
Christian Klieger is an anthropologist and the curator of an exhibit featuring Ishii at the California Museum in Sacramento.
Ishii was alone by the fact that he and his family had been hiding for 40 years. Because of the massacres of Indian people, a lot of Indian people went up into the hills and they hid rather than, you know, stay in town and suffer the prejudice and the difficulty of living with white society.
This was during a time when Native people of North America were referred to in animal-like terms. Newspapers and military correspondents, for example, generally called men bucks, while women were referred to simply as squaws. Countless tribal people, including Ishii's, were killed during confrontations over land and resources. But when Ishii became a public figure, white society's desire was to marvel at him rather than destroy him. Local newspaper, the Oroville Register, summed up the feeling this way.
Not a single word of English does he know, nor a single syllable of the language of the Digger Indians, the tribe which lived around here. Where he came from is a mystery. The most plausible explanation seems to be that he is probably the surviving member of the little group of uncivilized Deer Creek Indians that were driven from their hiding place 2 years ago.
Word of Ishii spread quickly, and as soon as the news hit San Francisco, it was academia to the rescue. Sort of. Again, Christian Klieger.
Alfred Kroeber down at Berkeley asked the Bureau of Indian Affairs if he could sort of take possession of Ishii and bring him to the new Museum of Anthropology in San Francisco.
At the time, Native people weren't considered citizens in their own homeland. Instead, they were wards of the federal government and were overseen by the Bureau of Indian Affairs, a federal office that still exists today. The Bureau granted Kroeber's request to keep Ishii with him rather than allow him to go live on a reservation. For the next 5 years, Ishii was measured, weighed, questioned, and recorded in an ongoing exploration of his life and culture. Beginning in September 1911, the San Francisco Call published an article every week about what was going on with Ishii, like this one published on November 11th of that year. T.T. Waterman was a colleague and fellow scholar of Kroeber.
Ishii, the last of the Yana tribe, was brought here by Professor T.T. Waterman, curator of the Museum of the Affiliated Colleges San Francisco, had his first ride in an elevator today. The Aborigine was the second member of the party to enter. He seemed to enjoy the ride skyward, and a broad grin was on his face. In the afternoon, Ishii sang an Indian song at a meeting of the Indian Association of Northern California. Professor Waterman apologetically remarked that some Indian songs are pleasing, but that Ishii's voice needed considerable cultivation.
That's how Ishii would spend the rest of his life, teaching his culture to scholars and the public, kind of like a living museum exhibit. Ishii shared traditional songs, stories, and demonstrated toolmaking. He lived at the university and worked as a janitor until he died of tuberculosis in 1916, just 5 years after being discovered. A number of newspapers, including the San Mateo Labor Index, wrote about his funeral.
The body was accompanied to the cemetery by several U of C scientists, Professor T.T. Waterman, E.W. Gifford, Assistant Curator of the Anthropological Museum, A.W. Warburton, L.L. Loud, and Dr. Saxton Pope of the University of California Medical College. One of those who officiated as pallbearer made a few remarks at the cemetery, commenting on the value Ishii had been to anthropologists in helping to complete the history of the tribe, incomplete until he was found.
Not everyone agreed on Ishii's importance to anthropology or on the nobility of UC Berkeley's study of him. What follows is part of a commentary in the Chico Record written after Ishii's death.
He furnished amusement and study to the savants at the University of California for a number of years, and doubtless much of ancient Indian lore was learned from him. But we do not believe that he was the marvel that the professors would have the public believe. He was just a starved-out Indian from the wilds of Deer Creek, who, by hiding in its vastness, was able to long escape the white man's pursuit. And the white man, with his food and clothing and shelter, finally killed the Indian, just as effectually as if he would have killed him with a rifle.
During his years at the university, there were some things Ishii kept control over, like his personal identity. Ishii is actually the Yana word for grown man. He never told anyone his real name, so that died with him. But there were other things he did not have control over. Before his death, Ishii requested that his body not undergo an autopsy. He had significant spiritual fear of this practice. But after he died, the autopsy happened anyway. And that wasn't all. Ishii's brain was kept in formaldehyde for 83 years after his death and passed from the university to the Smithsonian Institute before it was finally given back to his descendants to bury. In April 2000, the San Francisco Chronicle gave an account of when Ishii's brain was returned.
Leaders of the Redding Rancheria and Pitt River tribes, which traced their bloodlines to Ishii's extinct Yahi Nation through the Yana tribe, promised never to reveal where they buried him. And they're not saying when they will do it either, just that they're landing in California today and that they want to be left alone to shepherd their departed elder's spirit away in peace.
So what is Ishii's legacy? For some, the study of Ishii was part of the beginning of a change in the practice of anthropology into something more inclusive of Native people. Marilyn Salvador is the director of the Hearst Museum at UC Berkeley.
Members of these communities are becoming anthropologists and becoming museum professors, and it mitigates against objectifying others.
Salvador oversaw a conference at UC Berkeley this past September that brought close to 300 students, anthropologists, and history enthusiasts to discuss a century of Ishii.
We changed. We're including people as colleagues and professors and teachers and museum directors who are coming from American Indian communities all over the country.
But for many people, Ishii's story represents the common tragedy of Native Americans. Jessica Valdez, whose ancestors were from the Caddo, Comanche, and Apache tribes, is a young anthropologist who recently graduated from college.
If we don't stand together and make ourselves visible as a Native community, we're always going to fall victim to the people who conquered us. And that's how I feel when I think about Ishii. He was exploited. He wasn't taken seriously. His Native culture was just undermined.
Today, Ishii lives in the many books, films, and articles made about him. His ashes, along with his brain, have finally been buried. But it's not simply the memory of Ishii that lives on. His culture and descendants do, too. Again, Christian Klieger.
He was the last, that there were no more. Therefore, California Native people also must be extinct. That's absolutely not true. People are still here.
And these days, young Native anthropologists like Jessica Valdez are around to make sure those people's cultures remain alive.
Initially, I became interested in my upbringing as a Native person. I just wanted that to be a part of future generations to come, and I thought that it would be in my best interest to perpetuate my culture.
And after 100 years, Ishii himself remains alive in a sense. his voice, which was recorded with his permission, has been digitized from the old wax cylinders it was originally recorded on and preserved in the Library of Congress. It's what you're hearing now. In Berkeley, I'm Taria Smith for Cross Currents.
Taria Smith is a reporter with the UC Berkeley Graduate School of Journalism. You can find more information about Ishii on our website. It's kalw.org. That's also where you can subscribe to our podcast. You've been listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. The team includes Rose Arrieta, Hannah Baba, Julie Kane, Martina Castro, Jamie Katsoufis, Audrey Dilling, Fatima Duran, Chris Hoff, Artyom Skonohovs, Casey Miner, Erica Mu, Rena Palta, Lisa Ratner, Stephen Short, and Antoinette Sue. Today's show is engineered by Seth Samuel. Holly Kernan is our news director. Thanks to City Carshare, which provides an alternative transportation option for our reporters. City Carshare is online at citycarshare.org. And thanks to you, we are listener-supported radio. The music you're hearing now is by Zodiac Death Valley. The San Francisco band calls itself the loudest folk band in the world. You can judge for yourself on Saturday when it takes the stage at the Independent in San Francisco. For Cross Currents, I'm Ben Trefney.